Good afternoon, everybody. Hello. Welcome. Welcome to, this is going to be good, Financial Security, Why You Need to Own It. Right? Well, first of all, how many of us, I mean, we have very different ideas of what financial security is, and we probably all have very different definitions of what financial security is. But one thing we can all agree upon is that we really, really want it badly. And we're going to talk a bit about today about, you know, as women, we have sometimes a little bit of trouble talking about money, but not in this room. This is a safe space, right? So we're going to be very, you know, supportive, and nothing leaves this room. But we want to make it very comfortable because there are a couple of issues that we need to address, quite a few, about being women dealing with our money, whether it's how we were raised, whether it's, you know, ideas, gender ideas of, like, who does the money management in the house versus who does the investing. Or maybe it was taboo, or maybe you didn't grow up with much. And we heard Viola Davis's story. This sounds really crass, but I would love to know what her finances look like. Because how we grow up and how we are raised, particularly as women, really affects how we manage our money for the rest of our lives. And we know that we have certain hurdles to overcome, too, in terms of just socially, lots of gaps, right, in the way. So we're going to talk about that today. And the first thing I want to do is introduce this fantastic panel that we have here today to join us. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, actually. First, we'll start with Dewan Perrin.
Hi, I'm Dewan. I am a social media strategist. I've been working in social media marketing for 10 years. I was a single mom for many, many years, and that's kind of what led us me to be on this panel today. I am also a blogger on mamadjane.com. And that's kind of me.
Welcome.
And
Taylor Bradford joins us. Hello, Taylor.
Hi. So I'm Taylor Bradford. I am the editor of Taylor Bradford blog, taylorbradford.com. I'm also the host of the Boss Girl Creative podcast, where I teach bloggers how to blog and the nitty-gritty of blogging. So if you've ever been interested in blogging, I can teach you how to blog through my podcast. So thank you.
Thank you. And Dee Gastard.
Good afternoon, Austin. How are y'all doing? Good. It's good to see a lot of faces, some of whom I actually had a chance to talk to earlier. I'm Dee, of course, and I grew up just down the road in Houston, Texas, home of the 2017 World Series. Astros. Y'all, I have to tell you, I've waited my whole life to be able to say that, so I'm glad I got that out. So at the ripe old age of 17, I moved to Austin, Texas, into my first apartment to go to school at the University of Texas, and I've had the good fortune to be able to call Austin my home ever since, and so I'm really glad for that. I have 19 years of experience in this industry, and, you know, some people would call this a profession or a career. I actually kind of call it my calling, because I really, really love to speak to men and women just like you and have a chance to talk to them about their goals and what we can do to help them meet those goals. So that's very important to me. And in my free time, I have 3 German Shepherds, and you will see us doing rescue work with Austin German Shepherd Rescue, but also just tooling around town and having a good time and enjoying Austin. So thank you again very much for coming here today. I look forward to talking to y'all.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies. And I'm Carmen Rita Wong. I talk like this because I spent almost 10 years on television. So as a host of CNBC's On the Money, Today Show for 8 years, CNN, CBS, name it, I was there. And also advice columnist, Glamour, Essence, Latina, et cetera, et cetera. As an editor at Money Magazine. And one of my favorite strange gigs was a faculty professor at NYU, teaching behavioral economics in the finance and risk engineering department. Yeah, that needed a lot of coffee. So, to get things started here, this is going to be really fun. We want to encourage some real-time interactive participation from you. I'm sure I said y'all. Take your phones out. We usually say put your phones away, but this is going to take your phones out. Text this number, 22, is that up there yet? 333. And text Prudential MCM. And that joins you in here because throughout the session, we are going to ask you questions. And in real time, we're going to get to see your answers here. And some of this can really shape the discussion. So you're basically, you know, voting your influence to kind of what are we going to talk about today. To start, Let's find out about this topic and see what you're thinking. Give you guys a couple seconds here. The poll is, what does owning your financial future mean to you? Owning your financial future. So A is earning your target income, B being debt-free, C being on track with your retirement finances and plans, D having the ideal amount of savings to cover big-ticket items like a home, college, emergencies, etc., or E, other. I'll let you guys know. It's hard to see, right? Okay. So far, the winner is being on track with your retirement finances. Savings. Okay, retirement seems like a big one for you guys. And emergency savings. I'm actually weirdly encouraged by that. Yeah. Because I'm glad to see that it's not, you know, debt and other. So you have some really well-defined questions. What about you guys? What is owning your financial future? I gotta leave you that out of this one.
Yeah.
What is owning your financial future to you, Dwan? Which one would you have picked?
You know, I think I probably would have picked D.
Having savings.
Yeah, being able to make sure that I'm prepared for the future. I mean, yes, retirement. I kind of feel like retirement goes into that a little bit, but really the savings, that I can relate to that a lot of just emergencies and never knowing what might come up.
Yeah. I mean, all the polls show that the majority of Americans do not even have $500 to cover emergency expenses. And if you don't, you get just wrapped up in this cycle. What about you, Taylor?
Mine is definitely C. My husband and I are serial entrepreneurs. We started really young investing. I bought my very first rental property at 24 years old. Actually lived in it, still live in it, bought some things, came back to it. So we have those kinds of things, but we don't have anything else because we're entrepreneurs. We don't get a W-2. So we are concerned, like, what if the real estate market crashes and we don't have anything else to keep us going forward? So I'm concerned about retirement.
Okay, but it's very encouraging. So here you are, you're a property owner, right? So you're running this business. And there's so many of you today, not just those of us who are, you know, sitting up here, but so many of you in the audience who are powerful and successful in your realms. There's no doubt that we have come far since I was born. Okay, let's take a look here. I think we might have a slide or something. If you look at labor statistics, so imagine, so in the 70s, this is when I was little, the small amount of women who were in the labor force and in managerial professional jobs, you know, now, of course, that's close to 60% in terms of labor force, 40% in managerial. But we know, as we heard today, which, by the way, Madam Sandberg stole my thunder with that one, it is Latina Equal Pay Day, which I am very much vested in. And it's sad, but 54 cents on the dollar is not going to cut it. But for most women, 70 plus cents on the dollar is just not going to cut it. So we need to address that. But here's what's interesting. So even though we tend to manage the household finances, we tend to all, you know, be in the workforce, women's life insurance balances are 30% lower than men. And according to the same study, this is life insurance ownership focus, 44% of women have no insurance, and most of us who have it are underinsured. So here's what happens. The sum of that is, women retire with two-thirds the wealth of men, and we live 5 to 6 years longer. Now, you know, too, I'm sure a lot of us, I don't know if like me, are also taking care of aging parents, and you're stuck between that and the children as well. So you live longer, you have more expenses, you're taking care of more people, but we're not just there in terms of being financially prepared. So, Dee, what are you seeing in your practice and your work when it comes to women dealing with this?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things to look at. One of the things is we think that we're solely responsible for our own financial health, but Prudential has done some research and they found that there are actually a lot of external factors that play into how successful we can be in owning our own finances. And there are some different gaps that we face along the way. And those gaps actually do have an impact on how we end up dealing with our own finances.
Like the pay gap.
That's a big one. Yeah. In fact, there's a slide up here right now, and we'll talk about it a little bit. You know, we've all heard these statistics in some form. The fact that the average woman makes 79 cents to every dollar a man earns. This gap, there's another way to look at it, because it's not just the fact that we make a little bit less. But think a second about how this translates to things like Social Security income down the road. If we're only making 79 cents to every dollar, well, that means that we're making 20-something percent less on Social Security because of it. And that's not a good thing. Average woman in the U.S. spends 65% more on household work than men. You know, we call this the second shift effect, the idea that we have these jobs that we go to all day long, and then we come home, and we essentially have another job. We have to take care of the kids. We have housework to do. That 65%, that translates into 28 hours a week of home of work we do in our home, housework that we do.
That's the time gap.
That's a huge, that's right. We call it the time gap. And that is actually pretty huge. There's another impact that time gap has on us, though. Because we are the primary caretakers very often, we leave the workplace for a period of time to take care of those children. So we make less to start with, but then we delay the raises that we should be getting. Promotions are delayed. Our general upward mobility is also delayed as well. And all these factors kind of come together in this time gap that we have. Average woman in the U.S. lives 5 to 6 years longer than men. We call this the longevity gap. And there's, again, a large impact here, too, because we live 5 to 6 years longer. Think about how many 85 or 90-year-olds that you know, people that are of that age, more and more every day because we're living longer, right? So if you're 65 when you retire, that means you're going to have 20 or 30 years beyond that that you'll live that you have to have money saved for as well. It's a long time.
Eek.
And then this last one, I feel like this is the one that we have the most control over, actually. It's the idea that women do not invest to the same degree as men. And what does that mean? It means that we often delay starting our investments, and sometimes that's because we're delaying entry into the workforce or we've got a gap again, that time gap in the workforce. That's a big part of it. But we also somehow invest more conservatively than men, and that means that we don't earn as much in interest. And remember, if we go back to that longevity gap, we're starting later, we're investing more conservatively, therefore not getting as much bang for our buck in our savings, and we're going to live 5 to 6 years longer than men. So these things all tie together in how we have to look at our finances. And in fact, the fact that that last one is something that we can control, you know, it should kind of give you an idea about how you should start looking at your finances, the place to start when you're looking at everything together.
Dee, the great thing, though, that women really should know is that the research shows, and we're talking is Harvard, University of Southern California, these long research studies have shown that women invest better than men on average. We just have natural tendencies to do things like trade less, you know, research more. So we invest 1% to 2% more. If you add that up over and over, compound, it makes a huge, huge difference. Mm-hmm. Taylor, you mentioned, you know, owning the properties, right, and worrying about investing for your future. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so at one point I had a W-2. I worked for a company for 6 years, and they had a 401k, and they matched me 5%, and I was good with that. I was good. I am very, like, I want all my money to stay in one spot. I want to control where it goes, how often it goes, and I didn't want to do anything more. Well, my husband got my login to my investment and slowly started increasing me, like, by 1%. Like every quarter, and I never noticed the difference. And so one day we were having a conversation about how much was actually in my 401k, and he was like, oh, you've been contributing 18% of your paycheck. What? And I didn't notice it because I wasn't an hourly. I was working by kind of like a contracted rate, even though I was an employee. So I never noticed it because my paycheck was never the same. But it shows that I was like, I don't want to push any buttons. I want to just do the 5%. And he was willing to push the buttons. So.
And I'm glad you have a relationship where you didn't blow your lid. Because what I would have done if you went through my account. Anyway, Dawn, talk about how many, I grew up in a big house, so how many kids do you have at home?
Well, So now we have five. I'm remarried 5 years ago, and we have five blended. I have three on my own.
The time gap.
So I relate most with the time gap, just because unexpected divorce, and, you know, landed me as a single mom of three kids, and I did do all the housework because I was a single mom. So with the time gap, I mean, I was having to work and take care of kids and take care of the house and investments, and those things were like, no, that's like future. That's scary. That's, you know, it just wasn't even in the realm of something I could think about at that time.
So, do you feel like now that are you able to focus on it a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, and even before I got remarried, I had got to that point of, okay, I need to start planning for the future and I need to figure things out. One of my children has special needs, and so there's medical expenses there as well. And it was just, it's one of those things that, you know, you're always, okay, well, how are we handling the medical bills this month? But, you know, in the back of your mind, you're like, but what about those medical bills that are still going to be there in 10 years or 20 years?
That's a whole nother aspect too. And Dee, talk a little bit about how you see, I know there's being overwhelmed as a single mom. I'm one as well. And there's all these other issues that are on us that prevent us from doing the best we can with our money. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the biases?
Yeah, sure. Like, you know, one thing is the procrastination, I think, is one of the top things that I see. Boy, we don't want to do today what we can put off until tomorrow. And I think this applies to everybody, of course. So I see that as being a big factor in things. And our human nature kind of works against us sometimes, you know. Our things that are most important to us as individuals are things we have to take care of today. So, for example, in your case, you come home, you've got to get those other things done. It's easy to put off until tomorrow things that don't absolutely have to be done that are right in front of you this minute. There's also something called an optimism bias, and this is where we think nothing bad's ever going to happen to us. To other people, sure, but not to us. And so it's easier to just put it out of our minds and not deal with it for now. But of course, we do need to deal with these things. And eventually, they all come back to us, and it's our responsibility to move forward with things.
Now, as somebody who landed a show right when the financial crisis hit, one of the things in the financial industry in journalism, they like to say, crystal ball it, you know, and I used to hate that because, like, crystal, you can't crystal ball it. Well, you have to try, right? So we all want to try to crystal ball it, which means that because we have to think about our future selves, we have to kind of look into that ball and go, okay, what do we see? But maybe instead it's more, what do you want to see, or how would you like it to look? Taylor, how would you like things to look in your finances? What do you want to see in that ball?
Well, I want to know that we're taken care of, and I want to be diversified so that if something happens with this pot still exists, and that's my largest concern. And then I also have a concern of potentially taking care of my dad. Mm-hmm. If that falls into my lap, or if something happens to my dad and I have to still take care of my grandmother, who is in assisted living and has completely lost her memory, like, what do I need to do in order to make sure that I can even handle any of that? Like, that, all of those things run through my head. And as I get older, I start thinking, like, wow, we're really not taking care of ourselves. But where do we even start? I don't even know where to start.
Dee, when people sit down with you and they say something like that, Taylor's like, I don't know, where do I start?
Yeah, so I'm definitely going to talk about you specifically as well. But I would say a good place for everybody to start is an evaluation of what their goals are. And in your case, for example, it's, I want to make sure that I can take care of my parents down the road, or I want to make sure I'm covered if one part of my investments isn't doing well and I have to rely on something else to kind of fill in the gap and things like that. That often starts with a budget, which is a basic look at what you are currently spending on everything and how much you need for all the important things in your life. So I would say that's a place for everyone to start. Second thing I would look at is your emergency savings. And this is something that's very often overlooked, but we say that you should have at least 6 months worth of your expenses on hand in an emergency savings fund to pay for things that might come up. We look at debt reduction as part of that. That doesn't impact you right now, but if you have consumer debt, credit cards, you know, it behooves us to go to these lenders that have loaned us money and ask them to reduce that debt for us. See if they'll, I'm not sure if people even know that they can do this, But you can call these credit card companies and ask them to lower the interest rate for you. And you should take notes. Which companies are willing to do that for you, and which ones are interested in keeping you in that debt instead? So that's a place to start with things. There are also other things to look at. There's investments, and we can talk a little bit about different types of investments. Or
can I ask first, though? Yeah. I think a lot of folks would be interested. I want to go back to Duan. Some of you may be like me, kind of wondering. You have a child with special needs. When we think about our financial future, when we look in that crystal ball, a lot of us are looking and not just thinking about ourselves, we're thinking about all of those people that depend on us very much. So, Duan, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you manage financially for your family? It's a blended family. You have a child with special needs. How do you feel about your future there?
Oh, that's a kind of a, you know, it depends on the day. No, you know, it just kind of honestly depends on the year on what our medical expenses can be. Like this year, she had some surgeries. Back in 2007, she had brain surgery. She had half of her brain removed. When the doctors came to me and said, we need to remove her half a brain, I was like, people live with half a brain? Like, I didn't even know anything about this. And when we went into the hospital, they're like, oh, yeah. We do this all the time. You'll be in and out in a week and a half. We were there for 4 months. So, and I worked in corporate, and it was very much a, you can't really keep a corporate job and live in the hospital for 4 months. Mm-hmm. So things really just kind of flipped over for us, and that was when I was a single mom. So, and now we've gotten to where we have better insurance, and we try to make those right decisions of just which one's going to cover the right amount and how much, you know, do we estimate each month just for the co-pays, for the specialists that she sees, and then the medications, and then, you know, there's the deductibles. And so, like, this year we had $10,000 worth of surgeries, and that's just a regular surgery. So, I mean, it's not like a brain surgery. That would be way more. So preparing for that, it up until basically this year, it's been preparing for the next year and the next year of just how you're going to be able to handle that, plus the normal day-to-day spending. So that is something that now we're starting to get. And I do have that question for you, like, for someone who has a special needs child or a child with a disability, and they're trying to not only prepare for their future, like my senior care, my husband's senior care, but even for my daughter's care for beyond our years.
Yeah.
What kind of things do you recommend for them?
Well, this actually touches back on something we spoke about earlier. I would say that you know, we talked about women and in the home and how much time they spend on things there. They really undervalue their own worth to some extent. You don't know how much of that time you're spending on your family is really worth. I think we actually have a tool that it's called the value of all you do. And it's something that it can actually give you a value for how much of that time you're spending at home really is. And we use that to then, we bring it forward to insurance, which is actually a major thing that we're underinsured. We talked about that a moment ago.
Yeah.
But one way that we can have some protection for our families as well for down the road. There are types of insurance that can help people while they're still alive, and then there's types that will help you with your family in case something were to happen to you. The reality is women are very underinsured, don't know their own worth, but if something happens to the mom or to the woman in the family, the tasks that they were doing, somebody's going to have to do those tasks.
Well, traditionally in a you know, one income family, the breadwinner would get the insurance and the person at home would not. But if you add up what it would cost to replace all of that, I mean, I can tell you as a divorcee and a single parent, as you know, oh, and I all of a sudden had to pay for a babysitter every single time I needed to go or do anything. It's substantial.
It is.
It's huge. So replicating that, getting someone to help with the cleaning, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So you do have that value.
You do have that value. You have to recognize it, and you have to prepare for it.
Yeah.
Especially.
For sure. Let's do another poll, because we're going to mix. This poll is mixed up a little bit, because it has something a little more interesting in here. What do you need the most help with? We asked this slightly in the beginning, but this is a little more nuanced. When it comes to your finances, saving for college, we're assuming maybe your children's college, saving for retirement, debt, being covered in an emergency, fighting, also call that arguing, with a partner or family about money, or other. Saving retirement continues to win this race. Debt, being covered in an emergency. Okay. And again, emergency and retirement keep coming up, but debt is in there. And I love this, a 4% fighting with partner about money. I know you all are just, you know, you have that, but it's kind of down on the rungs, but it's there. It exists. If we had you rank it, I'm sure it'd be up there. And we're talking about a retirement a bit, but let's talk, debt got a nice chunk there. And a lot of times we don't. You know, when we're doing, like, when I speak at colleges, of course, this is like the number one topic, but in this audience, you know, we are talking, people are still worried about debt. There is still debt. I didn't pay off my student loans until I was in my 40s. So can we talk about that? How does that factor in?
And that may not be the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
Because
they were cheap.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad because they were cheap.
And that's why.
5%.
Right. You know, there's different kinds of debt that you can have. There are some that we consider good debt, although I use that word a little bit lightly. And there are other types of debts that we definitely do not want to have. So think about your mortgage, for example. Not a terrible debt to have, usually a very low interest rate, and you get tax help very often by having a mortgage. Then there's the consumer debt. This is the bad debt that we don't want to have, right? This is your credit card debt or other types of lending debt that you may have. And we do want to, as I mentioned earlier, we do want to find ways to draw that down as much as we can, as quickly as we can. Generally, we say that you should work on paying down your highest interest rate, lowest balance accounts first. And then after you pay that off, try to think in your mind of a fixed time period that you want each debt paid off in. And after you've done so, take all the money you've accumulated there and put that towards the next debt. And you can kind of create a snowball effect where you can pay your debt off faster and faster as you get a little bit of it done. Other types of debt. You mentioned student loans. You know, there are corporate student loans and then there's federal student loans. And this is an important distinction to make because federal student loans are generally going to be lesser interest rate loans, long terms to pay them back. And I don't worry as much for clients with that type of debt. They can pay it off on a regular basis. Corporate loans, however, can be very costly and they can be at much higher interest rates. So sometimes we end up having to put them in the realm of that other consumer debt in terms of paying them off quickly.
Yeah. And we deal with debt. You mentioned good and bad. I think there's, for example, Taylor, you have properties. So you have, I'm assuming, unless you paid cash. Girl.
No.
You did. Wow.
But I only have 6 years left, so.
That's okay.
Yeah. We decided to go 15-year mortgages so that we could have that money back in our pocket faster.
Yeah.
So.
And whereas, so one of the things I'd love to point out in times like this is that, you know, when we use these words good and bad, all of us can agree on something. When you know who you are as a person, you know how to manage your money. So, for example, Taylor, self-employed, runs a business, takes big risks, right? Dawn has a very different family life. She's really got to probably be a lot more buttoned up with her finances, can't take as many risks. I take a lot of risks as well. I know some people who don't. We all kind of have the same end goal, but a lot of us utilize these tools mm-hmm. in very different ways. But one thing we can all share is that everybody can use some advice.
Absolutely.
Right, Deke? Because, yeah. because we talk to a lot of people and they think that they don't have enough money to ask someone for advice, even to sit down and have a consultation. But that's definitely not the case.
That's not the case. Everybody can benefit from the advice, as we said. I would say look at the people that you can look at for advice, financial advisors, for example, as kind of coaches in your life. People that are there to learn about you, to learn about what your individual goals are, and then to give you some guidance in reaching those goals all along the way. And if you look at these folks as coaches, then you'll benefit from their expertise and their experience, but you'll still be in charge of your own finances. You are still the one who is the captain of your own ship, so to speak. So I would definitely say that's kind of how you have to look at it in terms of getting professional advice. And everybody can benefit from it, not just the wealthy. In fact, I'd say it's maybe even more beneficial for those of us in that middle class lifestyle.
And for women.
And
because
for
we have
women
so
especially.
Much more planning to do. And so many of us kind of hand this off and we only take care of the household budget. We don't take care of the big picture.
Right.
So we should. Speaking of that, you know, more and more we're seeing in our economy is this is becoming a freelance, self-employed, business owner economy. So when I first started in personal finance 20 years ago, you never heard of anything outside of a 401k or 403b, but now, more and more, of course, we're seeing retirement tools tax-friendly tools that we need to use as entrepreneurs, and a lot of us probably are entrepreneurial more so than we know. Can you go through a couple of those? We just have it quick on a slide. I just wanted to make sure that you get some of this information because it's really applicable and they help so much.
Yeah, I'll talk about it. And this is probably especially important for you to know, Taylor, because you are in that position where your most of your retirement assets are in property and real estate.
Yes.
And so you do want some diversification. There are some things that'll help you. And, you know, there are a lot of different retirement type plans out there. I'm not going to spend 2 hours talking about all of them, but I'll talk about some of the more important and possibly relevant ones. We think about traditional IRAs. And people don't know this, but you can have payroll deduction for your traditional IRA, especially if you're a small business owner. It's very easy to do. There's not any setup or administrative cost to it. And so if you are one of those person who doesn't have those resources to be able to administer a larger plan, a traditional IRA might be appropriate for you. $5,500 is the 2017 limit. And if you're over the age of 50, you can actually do another $1,000 in there. So a traditional IRA is a good employee-driven retirement plan. But there are other ones, too. There's a SEP, or a Simplified Employee Pension. This is an employer-driven plan where the employer has to put money in for all the employees. Again, very good for single business owners.
But this is great because I've had one forever, and the good part about it is the limit on it is not a dollar limit. It's a percentage of money you make. So the more money you make, the more you can put away.
Exactly.
So that's a big difference. And then we have the simple IRA, which fewer folks use. And these tools are very important to know, if only because this is going to help you if you own your own business and in general. And they can talk to somebody. You have somebody here.
Yeah, actually, I've got a few folks from Prudential here. You guys will stand up if you wouldn't mind. There's John and Paul, and there's Brad in the back. And if you do have questions after this, I do encourage you to grab any one of us. Ask us your questions. We're happy to talk to you. We also have a big booth downstairs in the pavilion where we can speak to you there if you wish.
And so now I'm going to open up to questions because we always get a lot of really good, very specific questions which apply to everyone, specific meaning to us as women. We've got two microphones here, right here and right over here. Please head on up. Tell us your name and then tell us your question. And again, it doesn't leave the room. Even though the door's open, close the door.
Just between us.
Just between us. Close the door. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question. You mentioned at the beginning something about the emotional aspects of all of this stuff, which really speaks to me. I hate saying that at a women's conference, but definitely, because I'm super emotional.
Like men aren't emotional?
Yes, I tend to make super emotional decisions, especially regarding money, you know, and I know that that's a problem for a lot of us, too, little impulse buys and things here and there. And then what you mentioned, too, about how your fears about money from growing up, you know, come to haunt you as an adult. So I'm curious if you have any resources or books or any of you or blogs or anything like that that would speak to the emotional parts of that, like healing that in ourselves. Because I'm curious about healing that to move forward and do some of this like more tactile stuff.
My future book. But in the meantime, I have a really good friend who I respect very much. She used to be on my show on CNBC. It's called Money Zen.
Mm. That's exactly what I'm looking for.
Because that can really help kind of give you some peace with your money. I think just understand that it's not that because we're women, we're more emotional. We're humans. We're human beings. So in the years that I've been covering finance, you find that people say, this is the way we do it in my house. This is the way I do it because this is the way I was taught. We're human beings. So we can have all the information in the world. No offense, Dee. Mm-hmm. But if we come up to you and we somehow don't feel comfortable with you, it could be simply because maybe you remind me of my cousin who's very judgmental. And right now, you know, who knows what it is, right?
Right.
It's just something can come up that can prevent you from doing what you should be doing. And when it comes to money, that is so incredibly important to take care of.
Yeah. I'll add a comment onto that.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of great financial advisors out there. It's really important to find somebody where you feel like you can just talk to them as an individual. There's no judgment involved, but they're going to answer any questions you have in a way that's easily understandable, where you can use that information to do whatever it is that you're trying to do. Okay.
And I would say stop. When you find yourself, I always do a gut check. If you are dealing with money and you have to make a financial decision and you literally feel something, stop and be curious about it. Mm. That sounds silly, but like be curious about it. What is that? Where's that coming from? What does that remind me of? And just take a minute. And if you do that every single time, it's going to come to you, this pattern and the why, and then you're going to be able to address it and get past it to something else.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. That was very helpful.
Good.
Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Joanne.
Hi, Joanne.
And I have a question in general about investing because I do want to invest more. However, over the past 15 years, as most of us have seen, sometimes this seems a lot like just gambling. And I'm gambling with my future. And I did not grow up with a secure environment, so this is really important for me to hold on to what I have now and make it better. But I keep seeing invest in housing, invest in a business, invest in a 401k. That's all kind of at the whim of whatever regulations are or aren't there at the time. So what investments can I invest in that would be more secure than the market?
So this is it's a little bit of a loaded question that you've asked me, because the reality is that when we talk about investments, one of the reasons that we really have to think about things is because we know that there's inflation overall in our economy, right? So remember I said that we tend to invest very conservatively. All of your views are very valid, right? When we invest too conservatively, we don't beat inflation, and then the purchasing power of our dollars is less down the road than it is today. So we have to take some risk on to be able to, at a minimum, beat inflation, but hopefully do even better than that. There is no crystal ball that tells us which investment category is going to be safer or going to be better. But this is a reason that we have diversification in investments, is because we try to have people exposed in different areas so that if there's one area that's impacted legislatively or otherwise, there are other areas that can kind of fill in the gaps for that. But this also goes back to, there's no one-size-fits-all plan for everyone. You really have to look at your own situation and what your concerns are, and we can find areas where maybe you feel more comfortable with certain types of investments than others, and I think that's really important.
So does Prudential have fiduciaries available for us to contact and speak with?
We do have advisors and act as fiduciaries, and so there are people that you can speak with, absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi there. Do you have any suggestions for questions to ask for a potential financial advisor? Like, what are the best questions to find a advisor?
Can I tell you what I tell people? This is what I tell people. Because I'm not in that business anymore. What I tell people is, I work with an advisor. Ask them, do you work with people like me? What that means is, and I'm not looking for kind of, you know, for you to niche yourself out, but advisors who know what your life looks like, advisors who have experience, for example, Dwan, with children with special needs. If you have medical issues, that's very, very important. So if you have particular, or entrepreneurs, find somebody who works with people like you, and I'm sure you have some.
Your advisor should be transparent about how they do things. So you want to make sure you understand how they work, how their business operates. You'd want to ask questions along that vein. They shouldn't be afraid to tell you how they get paid, for example. And you shouldn't have a problem asking them any question and having them give you a responsive answer to it. So,
thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, so if you're fortunate enough to max out an IRA and max out a 401k, what is the next step on top of that?
Yeah, there are.
Congrats.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's it. And actually, I spoke to somebody, and we were in the line at the Prudential booth earlier, and I had a couple of women who asked me that question. It's a great question. There are other things that you can do. We talk about things like life insurance, retirement plans. We call them LERPs, or non-qualified accounts that allow you to save a little bit extra. They don't have the absolutely fantastic tax benefits of a 401k, but there are other benefits that they do have. So there are things out there, but they'll have their own set of restrictions and rules. So again, you have to figure out for your personal situation which of any of those things will be appropriate for you. But there are things out there, usually in the realm of insurance and non-qualified accounts, that can assist you.
Oh, there's tons.
Lots of things.
No, there's tons. And not just insurance, because you can be on your own. You can invest in index funds on your own. You can do all that stuff. You just have different taxes applied to you. Right. Or you could do like this one over here.
Buy all the property.
Or take 5% like I do and do something fun.
Yeah. Are there books you recommend that sort of outline those different options?
Oh, gosh. Yes, there's tons. You mean just outside of the tax retirement, yeah. The tax-friendly vehicles?
Oh, so you want
there's
something
so, it's,
in
it's
general.
Actually very kind of basic, The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham is a great dry, make sure you have a lot of wine when you're reading this book. You will need it. You'll fall asleep in chapter one, but you'll wake back up and then you'll go through a couple chapters. But it's really, really best in terms of the best investing book. I mean, I have a book too, but whatever. But this is the best investing book in terms of an absolute overview of all of the tools available to you and how they work, mm-hmm. how you would gauge risk and all of that. Because it's really important. It's got to match your personality.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
So, for example, like I take a little bit of money and I invest in this weird thing, which I want. So, it's a website where basically you can invest in what's called motifs, right? Themes. So, like caffeine. And then what they do is they take all the stocks, like coffee stock, you know, and this is risky, so I would do not do this sort of thing with more than like 3% of your money. But it's, even if it's just a little, it's just something fun. It kind of reminds you a bit of how it can be fun to just be in charge of your own stuff. And it's kind of like when when I eat a whatchamacallit or something.
Hi. Hi. I'm retired from the state, so I'm living off my retirement. But I have a little money invested, both some inherited money and some I saved some time ago, and I've just left it. And I've recently been told that my what I thought was pretty conservative is not conservative at all, and advised to make some movements. And the guy that I was talking about said there's going to be, I can't remember the term, a course correction in the market in the spring, and I should expect that, and I'll be in big trouble. So could you comment on that?
He's a genius.
Crystal ball.
I know. Do you see the two of us are like, oh, in the spring? That's a crystal ball.
Did he give you a date?
That's what I
like
thought.
To take it down.
And, his assessment of my what I had was so different from the impression I'd been given early on.
Yeah.
No? No answer?
I mean,
it all depends. Is that
what goes up must come down. Yeah. I've learned that since I was a kid. Yeah. The market goes up, the market's going to go down. This is the way it is. If you had stayed in the market in 2008, you'd be perfectly fine, and then some by now. So there's a lot of, but you can assume that, but timing, market timing is what that's called, is not a very wise thing. And one of the things that women do really well is we don't do that. We don't tend to be like, well, this is going to happen in the spring and
sell everything.
And
that was my reaction.
Ooh,
like,
see, those are your
wait a
female
second
spidey senses saying, no, my brother, this is not how it works. But to your point about really looking at, and Dee can talk to this, when you really look at where your money is, where it's really invested, sometimes when you peel that off and look at it, it is a little over this way or over that way. So especially since you're in retirement, you can do stuff with that.
You know, we want to take an evaluation really of everything. This individual could very well be correct. You may be too aggressive for whatever your position is. So the first thing is to identify what your position is.
Yes.
This money that you have, what are you going to use it for? So you've got to know what the goal is for that money first. Once you know that, then you can figure out what really is the best way for it to be invested. And so often the answer ends up being it should be diversified in some way. So you have some opportunity for taking advantage of an up market, and at the same time you have some protection in there for when we have a down market as well. So that is, in general, the answer for a lot of those things. But really, it starts with you and identifying what the goal is for that pool of money.
Okay, thanks. That's what I'm doing.
Very good.
Thanks.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm not at this point right now, but I actually too work for, I'm not retired yet, but I'll be eligible to retire in my 50s because I work for a government agency currently, and I'm just trying to figure out what my next steps should be financially. I will be eligible to have a pension, but I will be in my 50s, and I've worked since I was 16 years old, so I definitely want to do something after that eligibility, but I don't know what that effect is for something like Social Security when you're maybe not working full time in your 50s. So just trying to kind of figure those pieces out.
That so can what, definitely affect your income after your retirement can definitely affect your Social Security.
Yeah, okay. You do need a financial plan is really what it comes down to, because you have to be able to know what the effect of, you know, what you need in that first year that you retire in your 50s is not going to be the same amount that you need in the 20th or the 30th or the 40th year.
Right.
Because inflation is going to affect all of that, right? So you have to know what the impact of that's going to be so you can plan accordingly, first of all. A couple of things I'll give you a little heads up on when you have ERS, you have a state pension? City pension.
But it's a bit similar. It's a fixed, we don't, once you retire, there are no cost of living increases. I think the state might be different.
So it's just a fixed amount, right.
It's a fixed amount, correct.
So you have to plan for beyond that, really. Right. What's going to be filling in those gaps after that? Social Security. You do get penalized if you have earned income over a certain amount and you are not at Social Security retirement age, which is probably 67 for you.
Okay.
You can take out Social Security as early as age 62. You'll take a reduced amount out, about 7% for every year you take it early.
Right.
But really, you might want to think about, do you want to have another job? Do you want to work part-time? Do you want to just relax for a few years and then go back into the workforce?
Right.
All those things will definitely have an impact on that pension. And I assume you have health care already taken care of within that
Correct.
Pension, right? Okay,
yeah.
Good.
I mean, you do, it is paid for, but, I mean, we have to pay for our own. I think the state actually, the state pays for the retirees' insurance, but we pay for it out of our pension.
Yeah, so you definitely need a plan to evaluate all those things together for you personally.
Okay, yeah. Thanks so much.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
So you guys were talking about good debt, you know, versus bad debt, and I'm worried this question is too specific, but back in 2006, height of the market, my brother tells me you should not be paying rent, you should buy, and I buy a condo at, like, the height, and then it crashes, and then I decide to move states to get a different job, so I start renting it out, and I guess the good news of the crash is that it was an adjustable rate mortgage, which I know is not great, but the interest rate went down to, like, 2.9%, which was wonderful. But now I live here in Texas, I bought a house, and I debate all the time, like, what is the right amount of good debt? Like, I'm sure at a certain point, it's bad to have too much good debt, even. So, like, what's a good barometer for figuring that out? Because I go back and forth of, should I sell the condo to pay down the mortgage on the house, or should I keep it both because they're both good, and I don't know how to figure that out.
Yeah, well, good or bad is all about your situation, yes, the tool. Taylor, can you talk a little bit about, your eyes just went, what? I mean, I just want you to talk about in relation to how do you kind of balance that out in what you do? Can you speak specifically?
No.
No, she's like, don't talk to me. It is a tool, and it's about how overextended you are in terms of expenses and what you've seen the market do, and also your plans for what's next. You know, where do you see that property plan in your future plan? Could it be used for something? What am I thinking?
Also, you know, how reliable your income is.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
Are you in a one-income family or a two-income family? Is there any cushion that you can fall back on when you're running more than one mortgage and you have one that's adjustable especially? That concerns me a little bit,
know.
I have to say.
I know.
Right. I might, just for your own edification, I might encourage you to
lock it.
To look at, look at exchanging that for a fixed rate mortgage. And interest rates are still very
pretty
good
low.
For that
yeah.
sort of thing.
Right.
So
right.
it can't hurt to find out what's available to you. And if you have a more predictable cost that you'd have to pay for these mortgages, then you can kind of pair that with whatever predictable income that you have and know what percentage of your total income would be involved in taking care of those things. So I would look at a few things over there for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
So my husband and I, we kind of know we want a financial advisor, right? We just had a baby, so obviously...
Congratulations.
Thank
Yay.
You. and it's great, but obviously that has changed a few things in terms of long-term planning. Mm-hmm. What would your advice be as to what the first few steps into finding the right financial advisor would be?
I would probably first start with referrals that you can get. If you have a friend or a family member who knows someone who they just love, that's probably not a bad place to start.
Okay.
Any advisor that you find through any site, by the way, you can go to websites like BrokerCheck, and you can look at and see if there have been any complaints against that individual. So you can check them out from that perspective as well, and I encourage you to do that. But I would always say, of course, come to the Prudential booth and we can definitely help you with that. Okay. But really, look and see if friends and family have people that they trust that you want to use. And aside from that, it's not a problem to interview a few different people,
Okay.
See who you kind of sync up with and who understands you.
Perfect.
Yeah. And the CFP, the Certified Financial Planners Association, so they have on their website, if you Google them, you can find people near you to look and you can see ratings and bad marks and anything
right.
like that.
CFP.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Or FPANet.org, Financial Planning Association.
FPA.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Karen Casey.
Karen.
And I have a question. It probably might be my own or it might be pertaining to a lot of us. My husband is much more knowledgeable than I am about our finances. And not just our finances, but finances in general. He reads The Intelligent Investor on multiple occasions. And so when I try to be involved, and he wants me to be more involved, but when I try, sometimes I feel less than. Mm. So is there a resource that you might have for gaining like a base knowledge so that I at least can come in not feeling less than?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you are not. Because intelligence isn't just knowledge, right? So I would say... even though I was New York Times, I would say, yes, Wall Street Journal has a really great kind of basic investing packages that you can get online. You can download them. You can put them on your phone and such and just learn the basics. But I would say the best thing that you can do is just read up. So make that appointment with yourself and read up on it, whether it's Money Magazine or Fortune Magazine, whatever it is. Get a publication or a blog or something that you like, that you trust. Please make it trusted, that you can go in and you can get a hang of all this so you can speak about it. But I would say this is one of the problems I see all the time, which makes me really mental, is when I see a woman come and they ask for advice and then they say, well, I brought this to my husband or my partner and he was just like, wow, well, the market's going to go south in spring. You know, but you need to be able to understand why that may be wrong and then have the confidence to be able to be like, but this is the way I would like to do things. Right. Also, too, don't forget that this is your money, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Well, I work and he works, so.
Right. So to not be afraid of managing your money and tackling that on your own, okay. Even if someone else is better. I always say when it comes to dividing the household, you know, finances, you can be like, okay, if you're better at managing credit cards and expenses, then you do it. And if you're better, but you always should know what's going on at all times and why. I'm just a big... You just have to. I've seen too many bad situations where people have lost that. So educate yourself so you feel strong about it, but also know that this is your right to have some say with it and to learn about it.
I just wish I knew more. And
learn. You can. Make an appointment. That's why I say so. Sunday mornings, this is what you do. You know, like Sunday mornings is my appointment with the paper, right, and the coffee. But make an appointment for yourself. It's kind of like how we make appointments to go to the gym, and I know we all do a million and 100 things. But this is so important. This is like your health. This is like going to the gym. This is like shopping for good food. This is that important. So make like an appointment that every week or every Monday or every Wednesday that you go and you look and you read and you educate yourself so you feel better about making those choices.
Okay.
And talking and have him teach you. Say, oh, they'll teach me about that.
Absolutely.
Teach me about that.
Sometimes I get
because that's how I learned growing up with my dad. You know, I didn't like sports. So my dad talked to me. I was like, so what's a stock? Because I was just trying to like hang out. And it really, really rubs off. So if you can do that too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that. I was going to say that sometimes we get so set in our ways of, oh, I just do this well, and so I do that, and then he does this well, so he does that, but you just never know. I mean, even if it's not divorce, it could be tragedy, and so maybe going to him and making that y'all's thing of like, hey, I really want you to teach this to me so I can learn this just in case, and I can always be prepared.
Yeah.
And if you're feeling a little overwhelmed, you know, I'd encourage you to start with one area and maybe read up as much as you can about that one thing. Maybe it's 401ks, or maybe it's about mutual funds, or whatever it is. And so you have some confidence about that one area and then branch out into the other areas.
It's actually not brain surgery.
It's not.
That was a bad joke. I didn't realize I said, but I say that every time I talk.
Hey, my daughter goes to school, and that's when at the beginning of the year, and the teacher says, like, tell two truths and a lie, and she's like, I have half a brain. Everyone's like, no, you don't. She's like, actually,
yes,
I do.
And listen to her. But it's true. It really isn't. So this idea that we've been taught that it's like, it's not. We can all figure it out. Okay, we have time for one more question.
Hi.
Hi.
So my husband and I have our money spread out everywhere. We have savings account, 401k, IRA, investments, which is great. But I also kind of feel like I don't know if there's a magic percentage of how much of our money should be in each one of those separate accounts. So I'm very thankful that we're fortunate enough to have our money in all these different places. But at the same time, I kind of feel lost to know how much of my money should be in all of those places.
I would say it depends on what your goal for each of those places is.
Which is
so you would just pair up wherever that money is and what its intended use is. Mm-hmm. And so if you know that you've done a plan and you need $2 million for retirement is what you have saved in that pile for retirement going to get you to that goal. Or if what you have saved up to buy your next house is in another pile, just pair up the goal that you have with the pile of money.
Okay.
And that's how I would figure out if you have enough or if it's in the right place.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because we're trying to save it for a house, but we're also planning for retirement. So
those two big things.
You can
I see
do
them
it
all the time.
No. Yeah, at the same time.
You can do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much for being here.
Yes,
Taylor, Juan, and Dee. Thank you guys so much.